There are two lines in one of Longfellow's poems which have a very classical ring about them. He paraphrases and rephrases a very early statement. It goes back to classical times. Longfellow writes, "The mills of God grind slowly, but they grind exceeding small." This thought seems to open a way to a rather practical insight into the patterns of life under which we live. I think everyone will agree that present conditions are not happy. They are not pleasant, but they are undoubtedly the inevitable results of the operation of the law of cause and effect. We have caused certain situations to arise in human society, and we must inevitably pay for the mistakes that we have made. Many persons of unphilosophical minds take the point of view that all these happenings are accidents. They are beyond human control. They arise from circumstances which we do not understand and we cannot overcome. This type of thinking brings with it gradually a certain fatalism and comes into violent conflict with the idealism that has always been present in human nature. We want to believe in good, but we look around us and we do not see evidence, at least immediate evidence, of goodness. We see all kinds of intemperances. We recognize the tremendous crisis that we face today in international affairs, and we like to think that we are the innocent victims of an outrageous providence. Some try to solve it all by simply denying that there is any providential factor. They like to think that man can do as he pleases, and that whatever he does is right because he does it. And mistakes do not really exist if enough people believe them to be correct. All this thinking has a dismal effect upon the private lives of people. We are all concerned with conditions around us, and these conditions appear to be worsening every day. And a certain hopelessness or helplessness sets in upon us. We begin to lose faith in deity. We begin to question the universality of laws. We remember a statement made not too long ago that it has required 6 million laws to attempt to enforce the Ten Commandments. We are in a problem. We know it. We recognize it. But we are unable to cope with it inside of our own natures. Human beings are transitory as far as this world is concerned. We are here for a time, and then we depart, leaving behind us the chaos that burdened us during our lifetimes. All of these doubtful factors, these dismal prospects, the anxieties over ecology and pollution, our fear that nuclear plants are going to leak poisons into the air, the difficulties in the Near East, the curtailment of our petroleum supply, these seem to be piling up accidents. They seem to represent a confusion that is basic. But actually, the confusion is not basic at all. There is nothing in natural law that says that these problems must exist. They exist not because of natural law primarily, but because of the violation of it. The individual has not yet learned to obey the plan of which he is a part. He regards himself as a person standing alone in the midst of confusion. He regards other people much as he regards himself. They are persons. They are doing things we do not like. They are doing things to hurt us. And as a result of that, we get tied up in short-range thinking, in which it seems to us that if we were running this universal show, we would run it differently. People have had that thought from the beginning. But if man had run it differently, we would not be in this dilemma. Now, it's obvious that the average person is not going to be able to make a universal reformation of mankind. And out of the problem, there comes a realization that integrity is a highly personal thing, but that this integrity, when distributed throughout civilization, would solve the problems that confront us. We have allowed in the last 50 years our moral and ethical codes to be deeply corrupted. And most of all, we have trusted our destiny upon one very fallible factor, and that is wealth. We are ambitious to have, and in the process of having, we have allowed ourselves to compromise practically every ethical standard with which we have been endowed. We have neglected to listen to the voice of conscience. We have failed to learn from the wisdom of the ages. We have failed the spiritual dedications that could have protected us. And now we find ourselves between the upper and lower grindstones of the mill of the gods. And this is not a very pleasant position. In the Orient, for example, the attitude towards this whole situation is very different from what it is in the West. Some ways, perhaps, we have improved situations, but in the main, we have overlooked the essential reason for human life. We are here to labor and to learn. We are here to help each other and not to help ourselves off of each other. We are here to work together for a common good and not to sacrifice the common good for personal ambition. Yet every day as we watch the news releases and listen to the informed or misinformed or uninformed commentators, we come to the same essential conclusion. The primary purpose of civilization as we know it today is to maintain an ever higher lifestyle. Lifestyle to us means opulence. It means to have the things we want. It means to go on with reckless spending and to, in any way possible, accumulate what we can, even at the expense of others. Now, this is contrary to the law of heaven, as the Chinese called it. This is contrary to the plan, which has its own purposes. And these purposes are all summed up in one great purpose: the salvation of all that lives. We are supposed to be working toward a better world. We are supposed to be dedicated to the gradual perfection of our society. The term civilization means the condition of living in a state of civility with each other. Civilization is almost a synonym for cooperation, but we have changed this and made civilization a synonym for competition. Every move that is made in our modern political tangle is calculated in terms of personal advantage or economic advancement. We have pushed the problem of wealth just about as far as it can go. And we are not understanding the situation if we assume that wealth per se is wrong. Wealth is something that is a heavy responsibility upon humanity. Our entire industrialized civilization depends upon wealth. The wise use of it, the proper distribution of it, and the moral control of it makes it a useful servant. But where we disregard these factors and make accumulation the primary end of existence, we are going to remain as we are now in a state of internal and environmental disorder and disaster. To begin with, we have to go and look at the individual, because the individual has a peculiar, divinely given right to live well. He may not always live in an environment that is doing the best, but this does not exonerate him. And in many affairs of living, we are always in a condition to advance the basic integrities of life. There's hardly a day go by when someone does not come to me with a sad story of how they have been cheated, defrauded, abused, misused, scandalized by those closest to them. We find constant problems in the home between parents and children, in which we see the gradual decline of our ethical control of ourselves. We know that our own lives could be made better, and that a person living well in an environment that is tragically difficult has a peculiar reward for his own endeavor, because after all, he is here for a time. He must leave what he has behind him, but he must take what he is with him. The great trouble today is that he is not sure what he can take with him. He does not feel very comfortable about his own conduct. He would hate to be interviewed on the gates of the other life and have a full story of his own conduct brought to his attention. He hopes, materialists particularly hope, that this dreaded circumstance will never arise, because when he is dead, and that is the end of it. Now, this oblivion at the end of life is a consolation for the corrupt. It is a means in which the individual sincerely believes that he can escape forever from the consequences of his own actions. He will depart, as his ancestors departed, and as his descendants will depart. And in each case, he will leave forever the troubles he caused. He will leave the mistakes which he permitted to endure to become part of the heritage of his descendants. The individual, therefore, in many instances, is seriously of the mind that if there is no life after death, he probably is better off. He would hope that oblivion will end it all, and that those who come after him will also pass into oblivion as those who came before him passed into oblivion. Now, there is really no scientific proof of this point of view. There is no clear evidence that the individual leaving this life does not in some way face the consequences of his own conduct. We are no longer particularly interested in the idea that a few virtuous persons, whose virtues in turn may be questioned, will go to heaven, and that for the rest, purgatory waits. This type of thinking was fashionable at one time, and also was a moral deterrent to corruption. The individual did not relish the concept of suffering forever for the sins he committed today. Philosophy has begun to analyze that situation and comes to the very simple conclusion that the universal power that fashioned all things did not intend that a great part of his creation should go to perdition forever. It was not part of the purpose that they should be lost souls. There was no reason to assume that the individual, part of a growing and unfolding life, should be thwarted, blocked, and forever condemned for the ignorance of a particular generation. The Oriental mind, working with this problem, came to the simple conclusion that whether we are in this world or some other place, we are there to grow and not simply to suffer. Very often we associate suffering with growth. We take it for granted that the individual, if he's going to try to live well, must live miserably. He must deprive himself of everything that the sinner and the backslider enjoys. He must live according to rules so strict and so stringent that most of the joys that we think of today, which are largely extravagances, are curtailed so far as he is concerned. He must live a lonely life of virtue in the midst of a happy and cheerful corruption. This situation, of course, is not exactly an appetizing interpretation of life, and there is really no truth in it, but we try to believe that there is. The human being, in adjusting to the times in which he lives, has many rewards as well as curtailments. The well-lived life, the consciously dedicated life, has many, many appreciations and rewards. The first and most intimate, perhaps, of these situations is related to his own flesh. The world in which we live today is very hard on the human body. The body was not intended to be abused. It was given to us as a wonderful instrument for self-improvement, understanding, cooperation, and mutual friendship. The body is a structure ruled by laws. It was generated according to law. It exists in this world in a functioning companionship with law. And when the body has finished its purpose, it returns to the natural resources from which all bodies come. But this body cannot stand constant abuse. It cannot sustain itself in a life that is dedicated to law breaking. And this is one of the situations that we face today, when probably more than ever before we find the encroachment of chronic ailments. We find the gradual decrease in efficiency. We find premature aging, and also innumerable heart attacks, nervous breakdowns, and mental disjointings of one kind or another. So the body is taking the brunt of our own mistakes, and it is arguing back. It simply tells us we cannot do it this way. So in order to keep on doing what we please, we try to, one way or another, medicate the body. If it is crying in pain, we give it a painkiller. If it's worn out, we give it a stimulant. If the mind becomes too heavy a burden upon the flesh, we can practically block out thinking with drugs. And a great many of our young people are becoming drug addicts to block out life. A life which they do not approve of, a way of life which they cannot adjust to, and responsibilities which are falsely placed upon them by circumstances over which they apparently have no control. So the body takes the first punishment. And it does not make any difference whether it is the body of the individual or a body corporate, a corporation, a nation, an institution. All of these are bodies to be used for the purposes of the advancement of human good. When they no longer serve this purpose, they begin to disintegrate. What is not useful does not endure. And use is not the fulfillment of personal appetite, but the advancement of character. So we have this little poem about the mills of the gods, in which there is added to our problem a vast dimension of integrity. And there's nothing that we are more concerned over at the moment than integrity. If we cannot find it in ourselves, if we cannot find it in our world as we know it, then we are definitely blocked in our natural optimism and our natural desire for self-improvement. If, however, we begin to recognize these difficulties not as punishments primarily, but as lessons, we can begin to learn something that may be of permanent value to us as we go through life. Nearly every pain we suffer from is a lesson. The pain itself is important. They tell the story about the man who, after a long series of experiments, was able to destroy the pain symptom in himself. He no longer felt pain. It went along all right till one day, not feeling pain, he sat on a stove, and that was the end of him. Pain saves. Pain protects. Pain guides us, warns us. But it is never regarded as a pleasant friend. It is always an adversary, interfering with the things that we want to do. In the world around us, we also come face to face with a situation that has been building up for thousands of years. We have inherited the disaster of the ages. We have inherited the mistakes that human beings have made from the beginning. We have inherited the wars of Alexander and of Caesar. We have inherited the invasions of the Mongol conquerors. We have inherited the wars and the hostilities of Napoleon, of Hitler, and of all the great ambitious men who have sought to fulfill their life destiny by destroying their fellow man. These inheritances have given us what the Oriental would call a heavy world karma. They have shown that the average individual will not, under normal conditions, change his ways. Man has developed a faculty that no other creature that we know possesses, and that is what Aquinas called a limited determinism. The individual can make certain choices of his own. He lives in a world of law, but he can interpret these laws according to his own needs. He lives in a universe of truth, but he can understand the degrees of this truth according to his own intents. He has a right to say yes and no. He has a right to be for something or against it. He has a right to investigate, to study, to decide out of his own experience that which is good. The individual today, however, uses this power of choice to choose to do what he pleases. He uses it as a means of deciding against the very rules which he should obey. He attempts to escape the consequences of action, but does not correct the causes of these consequences. Every generation is therefore faced with this tremendous burden of unfinished business. This burden, however, is a challenge. It is something that is here because we have put it here, because we have done certain things that have brought about the consequences we dislike. Now, the facts of this are very evident and quite easy to discover. Those who are interested, for example, in certain phases of human culture can read with profit Gibbon in his great book, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. It seems, if you read that book today, that it is a contemporary document. It shows exactly what happened to Rome. It shows exactly how it came to happen, and how the gradual deterioration of integrities and the constant expansion of personal ambitions finally resulted in the collapse of a great structure, a structure which had potential of a long endurance, but did not achieve it. We find the same in the histories of every nation. The mistakes we are making today are the mistakes that destroyed the past. The achievements of a constructive nature that we are making today are also present as bright sparks and bright lights in the long chronicle of history. Every good thing has played its part. Every new dedication has resulted in a basic advancement of human nature and human purpose. But from the very beginning, we have persecuted most those who told us the truth. We do not want wisdom to interfere with pleasure. We are striving desperately to be happy by a means that will guarantee unhappiness. This is as natural as cause and effect, and is a manifestation of it. We are much more privileged than the past, because we can review what has gone before. We stand probably at the point of the greatest potential enlightenment, but we are not willing to learn the lesson. We consider that all history began in the present century, and all that went before was a mass of myth and legend and mistake. Actually, the myths and legends and mistakes are dominating us today. We have not learned. Families do not learn. They go through many unsettled years, which may end in divorce or other separations, but they haven't learned what keeps a home together. They have not learned how to rule and guide their own children. When they go to vote, they do not know who they are voting for, and the only policy that to the average person is meaningful is to vote for the candidate from which we as an individual are most likely to profit. If the candidate helps us to maintain our lifestyle, we vote for it, even though the lifestyle may be wrong. Today, lifestyle has blossomed as never before. And in the more advanced or more prosperous countries, the standards of living are very high, but the standard of life itself is very low. We are building constantly outward things which are in themselves perishable and corruptible and will inevitably fall. So now we get the idea, perhaps, that behind Longfellow's lines, namely that we are actually always and forever in the presence of an immutable truth, an inevitable procedure, and that the simplest, happiest, most profitable and productive adjustment we can make is to adjust to this truth. Now, Pilate asked Jesus, "What is truth?" And according to the Gospels, Jesus was silent. Truth is a very big word, and in its own essence and substance is probably beyond definition. But there are certain evidences, certain secondary truths, which are very important in guiding us, even though the primary may be obscure. The truth of a matter is the reality of it. The truth of a situation is its factuality. But most of all, it is its definite integrity. Truth is incorruptible. Men can deny it, but they cannot disprove it. And truth is that we must cooperate or perish. There is no other possible answer, because we were made to cooperate. And whenever we do not cooperate, we place our complete psychic nature under stress. Gradually, as in the case of narcotics addiction, the false values which we have taken on become habitual. Furthermore, they become habit-forming, and ultimately, they destroy the discrimination within ourselves which might give us the strength to break these habits. So little by little, we are losing our relationship to the world of which we are a part. We are losing our recognition that we are here to grow, to correct our mistakes, and to advance gradually toward the fuller appreciation of truth, to become a little more aware of the truth of the matter, whatever that truth may be. This is a problem that today confronts us perhaps as never before. In the last century, industrialism and economic growth have become the great policies of life. We are constantly struggling with all kinds of complicated and difficult situations due to the interaction of these various factors, all of which have been allowed to get out of hand. So, instead of feeling that the world is in deep trouble, or that man's place in destiny is threatened, I think we should begin to realize that we are in a corrective period in civilization. It becomes obvious that if things continue as they are, we are going to be confronted by nothing but crises from now on for the unpredictable future. Everything that is difficult today is well on the way to being compounded. We are going to be faced with greater populations, dwindling utilities, corruption of air and water, and the development of nuclear weapons, which are distinctly and definitely unrealistic. These problems must be in some way solved. But before we can solve them really, we have to believe that there is a solution. Many people today doubt that a solution is possible. They doubt that the world can make these adjustments in a moderate length of time. This may well be true, and there's one thing we have to constantly remember, that we are in this world, but we are not of it. This world actually cannot control the thing that is inside of ourselves. No material force or power can corrupt man's spiritual heritage. There is no possible way in which the human soul can be damaged by externals. It can only damage itself by accepting, by recognizing and acknowledging things that are not true. So the mills of the gods are gradually grinding out the great problems of mankind. Probably the greatest problem with which we are confronted is ambition. And there is no one that can really write a good defense of it. Ambition is, of course, a pressure within us to excel in something, to become a greater expert in our own field of living or thinking. In large terms, ambition is the impulse to get ahead, to do things, to improve one's material estate. Ambition has caused all the miseries the world has ever known. Because in a world in which there are limited resources, there is no place for the aggrandizement of the individual. Now, the opposite of ambition is not inertia. Many people think that if their ambitions weaken, they are dying while yet they live. This is not essentially true. Ambition exists and can be used. But ambition should be devoted and dedicated to the definite labor of improving all things. Ambition should be the eternal hope of the individual that the world collective will find peace, happiness, and security. We should be ambitious for principles, but not ambitious primarily for profit. If we do all that we can to fulfill the impulse within ourselves to make life better for those around us, we have probably the highest ambition that we can know. Another tremendous pressure within us that is getting us into constant difficulty is selfishness. Selfishness is the mysterious attitude within ourselves that tells us that we should benefit most from anything that happens. Selfishness is self-centeredness. But in truth, it is not self-centeredness, because the real self is not centered in that way at all. The real self, with a capital S, is universal. There is one self from which all other selves are dependencies. They are fragments in the great mosaic of one eternal principle of life and integrity. Therefore, selfishness, really, as interpreted in the old philosophies, is man's selfish hope that all will be well with all. Selfishness is the ability of the individual, in the higher sense of the term, to be as thoughtful and considerate of others as he expects them to be of him. Selfishness may be fulfilled by living better than we have ever lived before. And in living better, we may be apparently focusing upon ourselves. But this is not wrong if, having attained to better, we use it to serve the common good. All selfishness should be an urge or an impulse to improve in order to be more useful. But selfishness which seeks to attain a superiority for the individual over those around him is contrary to natural law. Another common denominator of our negatives is fear. The individual is in a worried state. He fears the world in which he lives, and he most fears his fellow man because he cannot read the thoughts that dominate those around him. He is quite aware that he may be constantly the victim of a conspiracy. Fear has been tremendously exaggerated in recent years by a variety of literary productions and through the media. The media constantly tells us of the terrible things that are happening. Now, all these terrible things may be really happening. We're not denying that. But the impact upon ourselves is fear. We read all kinds of books about secret organizations that are seeking to undermine our world. We become terror-stricken. Fear is definitely man's anxiety about the unknown, that which cannot be easily explained, that which seems to be hidden behind something. Something that we cannot actually investigate, but upon which we can bestow all kinds of frightful proportions. This is fear, and many people are suffering from it today. The wise have never been afraid, and this is something that is very important for us to think of now. There is no need for anyone to be afraid of anything except his own mistakes. And these he can rationalize and understand if he wants to. The fear of the unknown develops all these negative anxieties because the individual recognizes the unknown as he sees it or senses it today as a vast uncertainty, a chaos, a kaleidoscopic mass of conspiracies, and he does not know which way to turn. The ancients feared neither life nor death. They feared neither the enemy or the false friend. But having come to a full acknowledgement of the law, they realized that there is no place in the universe for fear. There is no place in the universe in its natural state where there is anything that should cause man unreasonable anxiety. The only possible, legitimate source of anxiety would be natural disasters over which man has no control. But even these have their place, and natural disasters follow intimately upon the corruptions of society. Fear, therefore, is simply a hypnotizing, demoralizing, negative force. And it doesn't make any difference how we view it or how we measure it. The individual, as an eternal creature, living under an eternal plan, guided by an eternal wisdom, and protected by an eternal love, has nothing to fear. He has only to be afraid of his own mistakes. He is afraid, perhaps, that the negative part of his own nature will dominate him. If it does, it is because the good part has never had a chance. If, however, he really wants to overcome fear, he can do so. Because all fear is based upon uncertainty. It is based upon misinterpretation, misunderstanding, and the bestowing upon the unknown of malevolent factors. Out of the remote past, man suffering from all kinds of disagreements and disputes and dislocations in society, finally decided that there must be a devil somewhere. There must be an evil spirit that is doing these things. certainly God would not afflict us with plagues and pestilences, there must be an anti-God. There must be an enemy of God. And this enemy is continually conspiring to thwart the purposes of deity. Buddha, I think, had as good an answer to this as anybody, because he was also confronted by the learned of his day with a difficult problem to solve, like the problem of Caesar's penny. So when they asked Buddha about the place of evil in the plan of things, he said very simply, if God permits evil, he is not God. If he cannot prevent evil, he is not God. And they had no answer for him. And this point has been carried on down to give a lot of thought to things. I think probably one of the nicest statements of it that I know is a pleasant little story in which two little boys leaving Sunday school got involved in a conversation concerning the devil. One little boy said to the other, "Do you believe in the devil?" The other one said, "No, of course not. It's like Santa Claus. It's your father." We have plagued the world with devils since the beginning, and it's been very nice to be able to shift our mistakes on them. If, as is believed in the Middle Ages, there were demons under the front steps of your house, and they even came in and sat next to you in the pew in church, if this type of thing was real, then everybody could sit back and admit happily and cheerfully that it wasn't his own fault. Nothing that goes wrong is our own fault. We change that now. We don't have a devil to blame anymore. But we have politics, and we have economics, we have industry, we have international relations. All these things now take the place of the devil in one way or another and make it possible for us to feel that we are not to blame for anything. It's all stacked against us. Well, no philosophy of this kind can ever pull us out of the doldrums. It simply gets us in deeper than we were before. Let's take a very simple look from a Greek standpoint on this situation. The Greeks were convinced, in their own way, that there was one sovereign principle. That this sovereign principle can be called God, or it can be called life, or it can be called infinite mind, whatever you want to call it. It is one eternal principle, as Pythagoras pointed out. All division into multiplicity take place within this unity. There is nothing outside of totality. Therefore, all that exists, exists within totality. It is a differentiation of one principle into an infinite diversity of manifestations. But as they all come from the one, and that one is good, all of these manifestations are by nature and substance good. The world in which we live is a mystery to people, and to all of us to a great degree. For some reason, which rests only in the divine consciousness, the individual is not born with a full apperception of the unity of life. He is not born with his mind already set in the direction in which it should go.